Well, good afternoon, and thank you for the nice introduction. I will elaborate by saying two of my most prestigious publications were in the Penn Law Review in the 1990s, and more recently in Penn's Regulatory Review, which is they're both outstanding publications. What I'd like to talk about briefly today is the Supreme Court's decision last term in the Rahimi case, upholding the federal ban on gun possession by people subject to domestic violence restraining orders, but to put that in the context of the longer search for an appropriate standards of review in right to arms cases. So let's start in the early days. The Supreme Court, over its more than first two centuries, rarely addressed Second Amendment issues, just as it rarely paid attention to First Amendment issues until starting in the 1920s. And when the court mentioned the Second Amendment right to arms, they did so actually in 35 cases before the Heller decision in 2008. But the vast majority of almost all of those decisions treated the Second Amendment as a normal individual right, but they rarely elucidated much about that right, because they were usually things where the Second Amendment and other elements of the Bill of Rights appeared in an opinion that was making a point about something else. So, for example, in Presser versus Illinois, they said a ban on armed parades without a permit, 1886, does not violate the Second Amendment. In the Cruikshank case, which was a follow-up to the slaughterhouse cases in the early 1870s, they said the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment and the corresponding Section 5 congressional enforcement power under the 14th Amendment applies to state action and not to private actors. And even back in Dred Scott, where Chief Justice Taney was reeling off the list of horribles that would result if the court actually did what it should have, which is recognize that free black Americans are citizens of the United States. He said, well, if we did that, then, you know, that would mean they could go wherever they want without need for passes. They could have meetings on public affairs without any prior permission, and they could keep and carry, and they could carry arms wherever they went. But all of those were short appearance, you know, those are some of the longer things. The 1939 case of United States versus Miller upheld the National Firearms Act of 1934, which set up a tax and registration for certain types of arms, most famously machine guns, but also short-barreled shotguns. The Department of Justice, having been self-defeated by very poor litigation in President Roosevelt's first term, by the second term was getting more clever, and to uphold the 1934 National Firearms Act, they found the perfect case in 1938 with two bootleggers in Arkansas who had sawed-off shotguns, and they found an ideal judge to do it, a former congressman who'd been a gun control advocate and was newly appointed to the bench. He dismissed the indictment against the two bootleggers with their short-barreled shotgun in a sentence. The opinion was barely more than a sentence long, and it said this appears to violate the Second Amendment. Didn't give any reasons why, but it was the perfect setup for the Supreme Court, because at the time, the federal statute were held unconstitutional, then the government could go straight to the Supreme Court. And to make it even better from the government litigants' point of view, when it got to the Supreme Court, the attorney for the defendants said, I don't have anything to say. Rely on the government's brief. Presumably, he was not working for a legal aid organization, and maybe his bootleg clients weren't paying his bills. In any case, the Supreme Court 8-0 said this overturned the dismissal of the indictment, and they said that we can't take judicial notice, you know, obviously, which is where the judge notices something that's not in the record. We can't take judicial notice that a short-barreled shotgun would be of any use to a well-regulated militia. So there was, maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, but there's no evidence before us. So the dismissal of the indictment was improper, and that was the end of the case, and that was the last the Supreme Court had to say of any depth on the Second Amendment until the 2008 Heller case. Although it continued, we did have plenty of brief appearances where the Second Amendment sort of shows up, like the all the individual rights relatives of the family photo, but it's not sitting in the front row. So Heller in 2008 held that the District of Columbia's ban on possession of handguns and requirement that any handgun that you did have, or any gun you had, like a grandfathered handgun or a long gun, be locked up and inoperable, so incapable of use for self-defense in the home. The court in Heller did a very close analysis of the text of the Second Amendment and also supplemented that with analysis of its meaning of the meaning of the right to arms as understood before the Second Amendment was ratified in 1791 and thereafter, with the greatest most persuasive sources being those that were closest in time. So, and like all Supreme Court cases, the Heller case had lots of dicta in it about various things. And as the Third Circuit and every other circuit has said, even Supreme Court dicta, particularly when recent and unquestioned, is nearly as binding on us as the Supreme Court holding itself. And then 2 years later, in McDonald versus City of Chicago, the Supreme Court incorporated the Second Amendment via the 14th Amendment, making it enforceable against the states. The analysis was again very closely tied to 14th Amendment original meaning, the majority going off on the Due Process Clause incorporation, which is now well established in precedence. Justice Thomas's concurrence got even closer to the actual original meaning and would have used the Privileges or Immunities Clause, but it for these purposes, it comes out the same way. So the Supreme Court there had used a methodology, namely text, history, and tradition, to discern the meaning of the Second Amendment, but it had not officially said, and all you lower courts, you should copy us and do your Second Amendment cases the same way. And when the Second Amendment, well, there was a fairly well-developed body of state constitution case law, with, of course, the state constitution's right to arms provisions having a lot of variance, the federal courts were a little confused about what to do after Heller and McDonald opened up the Second Amendment as something where they would have to be making decisions. And the leading decision that lower courts followed actually comes from the Third Circuit. Shortly after Heller, it was called United States versus Marzarella. There's a federal statute that says you can't possess a firearm with an obliterated serial number. Federal law requires new manufacturing of firearms to have serial numbers, but there are some older guns that don't have serial numbers, and those are fine. But if you get a gun with a serial number and you obliterate it, you are committing a federal felony. And Marzarella's lawyer brought up the Second Amendment as a defense to that, and the Third Circuit panel said, well, we think we're going to adopt basically the tiers of scrutiny. Strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, and actually many flavors of both of those that exist if you take advanced constitutional law or 14th Amendment. But here we'll apply, and that exists in First Amendment free speech and also for 14th Amendment equal protection. And the Third Circuit said, We'll do that, and we will use intermediate scrutiny in this case because, you know, this isn't forbidding somebody to have a firearm or saying you can't use a gun for self-defense or something like that. It's like, what's the big deal? You know, your gun already had a serial number on it. Is it, how much does it impede your practical exercise of the right to lawful self-defense to be able to scratch the serial, take a file and remove the serial number from the gun? Not much. And so the Third Circuit upheld this statute under intermediate scrutiny. And their methodology became known as the two-step test. And step one is decide if what's going on in this case involves the Second Amendment right as traditionally understood. And here, Mr. Marzarella, yeah, he had a handgun. That's part of the Second Amendment right as traditionally understood. And then that's step one. Step two is let's apply something from the tiers of scrutiny. They applied intermediate scrutiny and upheld the statute. The two-step test, as it was known, was widely adopted by the federal circuits. The exceptions, notable exceptions, were the Eighth Circuit, which said, no, we're going to do text, history, tradition, because that seems to be how the Supreme Court's doing it. In the first D.C. Circuit case, the majority adopted the two-step test, while then-Judge Kavanaugh, in dissent, said, no, we should do text, history, tradition, because that seems like the Supreme Court methodology. And the First Circuit also went for text, history, and tradition, although they abandoned that after a while. In a case involving bans on common firearms, probably understanding that they couldn't uphold it under text, history, tradition, but they could under balancing tests. And these tiers of scrutiny balancing tests, I think many people would say, as a practical matter, work out well enough on First Amendment free speech and on equal protection issues. And that's partly because I think courts and judges have internalized the values of free speech and equal protection and apply them conscientiously. Not that litigants always win against the government, but they get a fair chance. The problem with the two-step test as it existed in Second Amendment cases was that in some places, notably the Second, Fourth, and Ninth Circuits, although not limited to them, tiers of scrutiny was perverted into something that really had little to do with the normal way you would be taught intermediate scrutiny in a constitutional law class. For example, under intermediate scrutiny, the government has the burden to show some evidence, then the other side shows its evidence, and then the government can come back with counter evidence to try to rebut what the other side showed, and you see how it lands. But as in this bizarre form that was created only for Second Amendment cases, the test was, does the government have some evidence? And you really do have to show up in court and have somebody wearing a suit and present some evidence. And then if you did, you win automatically. Don't look at the counter evidence. Don't look at the fact that, you know, if you have expert A, don't look at the fact that expert B has explained why expert A is wrong about everything. So you had, for example, in the Ninth Circuit, litigants would sometimes win in district courts or before three-judge panels, but never survive en banc. And so the Ninth Circuit, home of some of the most repressive gun laws in the country, with California and Hawaii, developed a record of over 50-0 of never upholding a Second Amendment claim under any circumstances. Which then brings us to the 2002 Bruin decision, where the Supreme Court saying that New York cannot limit the right to bear arms only to people whom the government thinks have a special need to exercise that right. This Justice Thomas's opinion said, away with this two-step test from the lower courts. You were all getting it wrong. Two steps is one step too many. You should have done it the way we showed you in Heller and McDonald, and since you didn't get the hint, now we're going to tell you to do it the way we did it in Heller and McDonald. And this doesn't mean, the court emphasized, that the only gun laws you can have are the ones that existed in 1791. Rather, post-enactment Tradition can be relevant, particularly when it's the mainstream or widespread and not outliers. And the main thing you can look for is in analogies. You look at the how of a law burdened the Second Amendment right, and the why of a law of how a law burdened why a law burdened a Second Amendment right. You do not need twins, said the court, but you do analogs. And of course, it being part of a constitution, it's not meant to be fixed forever in applications, and it's adaptable to unforeseen circumstances that that were not seen at the time of adoption. And so it was really saying, just do the first, just stick with that step one from the two-step test and do that. Is it part of the right to arms as traditionally understood? Yes or no. And as traditionally understood includes laws that restrict the right to arms that were not seen as in infringing it. Which then brings us to the Rahimi case from last term. 18 United States Code, Section 922G, has a list of 9 categories of people who are prohibited by federal statute from possessing arms. Should you become a U.S. attorney or a federal defender and just have the generic criminal cases, you will have quite a lot of these things. The relevant one here was 922 G8, which is the ban on people who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders. Like much of federal criminal law, this was a mainly performative act by Congress. States have long enacted their own statutes on that subject. There was not some desperate need for a federal statute to come in and do this. This is not some, you know, interstate matter that the states were incompetent of dealing with. It was bread and butter criminal civil law type issues. But that's true for half of the federal gun control laws and many others, that they're more performative than empirically based. The Fifth Circuit, for reasons that were essentially similar to what I'll describe in Justice Thomas's dissent, said, sorry, this statute doesn't pass Bruin's text history tradition test, and so we hold it facially unconstitutional in the Rahimi case. Rahimi's lawyer, of course, was very wise to frame the challenge as purely a facial challenge, because as applied, there's no better person you could have applied it to than Rahimi. Rahimi, a U.S. citizen, was at a restaurant and got into an argument with his non-live-in former girlfriend, with whom they shared a child in common, and then he shoved her into the car. She heard a head on the dashboard. A bystander happened to see it, and so he pulled out a gun from the underneath his car seat and fired the gun either in the direction of the bystander or the girlfriend. Later, called her ex-girlfriend, called her, threatened to shoot her if she reported it, and she nevertheless went to the authorities and got a restraining order against Rahimi from Texas, from a Texas court, and that restraining order then interlocked with 922 G8 to prohibit Rahimi. The restraining order, by its own terms, prohibited Rahimi from possessing a firearm for 2 years, and 922 G8 layered on to that to make his possession in violation of the restraining order into what was then a 10-year federal felony is now a 15-year federal felony. And by unproven allegations that still remain a subject of criminal trial, he was involved in 5 more shootings thereafter. Never actually hit anybody, but when the police searched his apartment after one of those, they found a firearm, ammunition, and a copy of the restraining order. So definitely should not have a gun. But the question is, does this federal statute violate the Second Amendment? Here's what the Supreme Court did not find, and expressly did not find. They first of all said, we're not saying anything about the due process and how this was issued. But you can look in the briefing, Rahimi's brief, which was, his lawyer was very good. There's terrible due process problems, not in every state, but in many states, about how domestic violence restraining orders are issued. For example, in Texas, if you contest a proposed order and you lose, you have to pay the district attorney's attorney's fees. And you know, there's a lot of people for whom that might be financially impossible. It's quite common in many courts to just issue routine reciprocal orders you don't like him, you don't like each other, good. Both stay away from each other, don't do anything violent to each other without any necessarily misconduct on the part of one party. The court did not decide about the constitutionality of bans on classes of people who are considered dangerous. In federal law, classes of people who can't possess arms or unlawfully present aliens, people who have renounced U.S. citizenship, people who have been dishonorably discharged from the military, and unlawful users of controlled substances. And in the briefings, the government in many other cases below, and some of the amici in before the Supreme Court, said there's no problem with class-based bans. Look, they had, you know, in the 19th century, the slave states had lots of laws against slaves or free blacks possessing guns or very tough licensing systems on it. There were occasional bans, particularly during the two states during the French and Indian War, restricted firearms ownership by Catholics to confiscate their guns unless they would take a loyalty oath, you know, things like that. Despicable laws that are actually separately outlawed by subsequent constitutional enactments. And the court said, we're not going to get into any of that kind of stuff because this isn't a class-based thing. This is a case where you had, in the civil court, a particular finding by a court with a person who had notice and an opportunity to appear. And you had findings on the record of facts that this person has committed violence and is a specific danger to other people. Said the court, that's the only thing we're talking about here. And said the court, we are only talking about subsection C1, which is about the situation I just described. And we are specifically not upholding subsection C2, which doesn't require any finding of fact. And it merely says this is valid. The ban goes into effect if you have an order not to commit future violence, as if with no finding at all of any misconduct or any threat. And I will immodestly say I wrote the only amicus brief in the case that distinguished C1 from C2 and said C1 is fine because there's a good enough tradition of disarming provably dangerous people, but C2 doesn't have any findings of fact about anything. And so therefore that can't possibly be a constitutional basis for disarmament. And the court said, we got nothing to say about that C2 thing. We're only upholding C1. The court upheld the ban based on saying it was sufficient based on two traditions in American legal history. First is what are called going armed laws. If you go armed to terrify the public by both common law and sometimes by statutory enactments, your gun could be taken away and you could be sent to prison. So, you know, if you, as in one case, ride through the courthouse with a gun on your horse and firing off the gun in the air as you do that, that is you will not only lose your gun, you can end up in jail. And second were surety of the peace statutes, and again, these have a common law base and sometimes statutory enactments. If you are threatening to breach the peace, then somebody can bring a case, and you, having threatened to breach the peace, can be required to post a bond for good behavior. And if you don't post a bond, then you got to stop carrying guns. You know, that you can either And there was an exception if you were, if the carrying was for self-defense. But in general, you lose your right to bear arms unless you posted a bond for good behavior for a certain period. And the court said, the majority, 8-1 by Chief Justice Roberts, that's good enough. You know, maybe not those two things I just described individually, but you put them together, that gets us the principle that you can disarm people with a civil process, not the criminal level, based on specific evidence of their threat of their individualized dangerousness. Justice Thomas's dissent said, yeah, you know, you basically admit the two aren't good enough one at a time, and you're combining them, and that's really stretching things too far. But what this is, in either case, is exactly, it makes all of you 1Ls, what you're learning this year is exactly what you need to do in these kind of cases. Despite ridiculous criticisms from some quarters, the Bruin decision and Brahimi's explication does not require judges or lawyers to become historians and to go through archives and find somebody's diary entry that was written in a secret code or anything like that. It's simply looking at legal history, statutes, treatises, case law, and look at those precedents and make analogies and argue for or against them. And you can, as you're learning, argue for or against in a lot of situations. And that's exactly what we had in the Rahimi case. I think the 8-1 decision from the court indicates that as lower courts look at the how and the why of precedents for gun control laws, that probably the how or the why can count more than the why, and you can be a little looser on the why. And so Brahimi sets you all up well to become good Second Amendment lawyers, even if you were not, did not get a PhD in history before attending law school. So, thank you.
Thanks for your comments.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
I'm already getting laughs here. My role is to respond to what the speaker said, and generally you're supposed to get some sort of debate or quasi-debate going, the counter speaker. Let me say to start that I'm a great fan of FedSoc generally, and particularly our chapter. They put on great events. I'm really always happy to be invited in to participate in these. I don't have a whole lot to say in response to David. He's focused, we start with the constitutional text, we end up with a holding, right? We got the Second Amendment, the text of which he didn't present to us, not perhaps relevant to what he's up to. We start with the constitutional text, and somehow we wind our way down to get a holding and say, Mr. Rahimi, you go free, or you go to prison. A lot of steps between the first and the last. And Mr. Koppel's focused on application of the existing doctrine. So we have a bunch of tests. He starts us off back in the 19th century, and then we get to Miller, and then ultimately a lot of years pass, and we get to Heller, and Heller's presented as sort of, you know, without a whole lot of controversy. You know, they looked at the history, came up with this idea, they said some stuff, and McDonald comes along and gets incorporated, everything. Yeah, there's maybe some dissents, maybe not. And then finally we get to Bruin, and Bruin announces this new doctrine, text, history, and tradition, all of which is passed over as sort of unproblematic, nothing to see here, move along. And then the question that he's interested in is, how do you apply the test? And I think my takeaway from his account is Rahimi basically is perfectly consistent with Bruin. The lower courts had read Bruin a little too strictly, at least some of them had, and felt that a gun regulation would be sustainable only if you could find something in our history or tradition, which is really is on all fours with the the present challenged regulation, a twin. But that's not what Bruin had required. It had only required an analog. So those courts that had read it too strictly were mistaken, and Rahimi just said, you're mistaken, you're reading Bruin incorrectly. The test is, look for some analogy, close analog, in terms of why, what they're prohibiting and their reasons for it. And if you satisfy that, good enough. So that's the application. He's interested in Rahimi sort of clarifying or just reiterating the doctrinal test announced in Bruin and applying it. And I don't really take issue, I think, with anything that he particularly said. Not my department, I'm not a gun rights guy, I'm not that interested generally in the application of the doctrine. What I'm interested in, I'll spend a few minutes talking about, is what happens upstream from the point at which Mr. Koppel takes up the story, or what he's focused on. As I say, I take it, as I listened to him, I thought that he presents this text history and tradition test, and he's interested in applying it. And he tells you guys, when you guys go out and become lawyers, you're not going to be doing that much reinterpretation of the Second Amendment. Your cases are mostly about applying existing doctrine. And he's saying, yeah, you can do it. You don't have to be some sort of historian, maybe. Just have to look for analogs and make arguments about whether something is analogous. So you should have some good cases, be interesting, and you're not unfairly impeded in your ability to do your lawyering job. But how did we get to this test in the first place? And that's the question that interests me. I'm not a Second Amendment expert, but I would just like to put a little more meat on the bones of what we didn't hear. So first is the Second Amendment starts off with a preamble. It has two clauses. A preamble or prefatory clause and an operative clause. A well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I think it's pretty much close to a quotation verbatim of the
95%.
Okay, and so good enough for academic work. So the prefatory clause suggests that the right that's protected under the Second Amendment has something to do with collective self-defense, something having to do with a militia. That's what the prefatory clause suggests. So that's why courts had interpreted in the past not to protect what's sometimes called an individual right to bear arms, but it's a right in the context of a militia, whatever exactly that means, and it's complicated. What happened in Heller was the great textualist Justice Scalia just wiped away the prefatory clause as though it didn't exist. Why? Because he said, well, when we look to the original understanding, what was the original treatment of prefatory clauses in 1791? A prefatory clause had legal effect only if the operative clause were ambiguous, only if it's ambiguous. But here he says, there's no ambiguity. The right to keep and bear arms, based on historical sources, is an individual right. Therefore, we should turn a blind eye to the prefatory clause. It has no effect on how we interpret the scope of the Second Amendment and what it protects. This part of Scalia's opinion, I have to say, not to mince words, was completely bogus. Just ridiculous. Ambiguous. I'm not saying now that the right, the better understanding of the operative clause is that it's for collective self-defense as opposed to an individual right. But the historians who have looked at this, of whom I'm not, say that actually the operative clause is very ambiguous. Why? Because there are a ton of references, period appropriate references to bear arms, that make clear that that phrase is used in the context of military possession, not individual possession. Not all of them, but most of the usages of bear arms. And then Scalia says, no, that's only bear arms against, and the phrase bear arms against. That's not true. It's just not true. And that's really important, because if he didn't overclaim with respect to the operative clause, then boom, the prefatory clause comes in. And the prefatory clause then would have legally operative effect in telling us that the scope of the right is much narrower than Heller held. So I just think that he was dishonest in his treatment of the history, as most professional historians of the period have concluded. And in fact, in MacDonald, Alito was much more honest. In MacDonald, Alito acknowledged that the historical evidence upon which Heller had relied was rather more controversial and ambiguous than Heller had claimed. But as I say, Heller's claim about the non-ambiguity of the text wasn't harmless or irrelevant. It's what enabled Justice Scalia to pretend that the prefatory clause didn't exist. That's not so cool. Then we get to Bruin. What's the text? Well, we hear text, history, and tradition. What exactly is text, history, and tradition? I'll tell you what it isn't. It's not originalism. Why? Originalism is a historical inquiry, but originalism has a fixed point in time that matters. It's the point of ratification of the relevant constitutional provision. Nothing that happens afterwards is operatively significant for an originalist. Right? History and tradition is not just about 1791, it's looking at our practices since 1791. That's not originalism. I say that it has to have operative significance. It can have evidentiary significance. So things that happen afterwards might tell us something, maybe, about what people understood or intended at the time of ratification, whichever is your touchstone for an originalist. But otherwise, for an originalist, post-enactment history is not relevant. What we're seeing, though, is lots of justices, even justices who claim to be originalists, find that history and tradition is pretty useful to them, and it's something they want to take account of. When? When it will help them reach the politically conservative result that their priors want them to reach. So I don't think that the reference to history, to text, history, and tradition should be just passed over as though it's a nothing burger. It's a something burger, and what it shows is that people who claim to be originalist are changing what they're focused on when it suits their purposes, it seems to me. Why is history and tradition so darn relevant here? Well, the thought, it's not the case that people have always regulated to the extent of their regulatory authority. The fact that they didn't regulate X is rarely, rarely very good evidence that they lacked the power to regulate X. There are lots of things that government has the power to regulate, which it chooses not to. Our world is so vastly different. The use of guns is so vastly different. The weapons themselves are so vastly different. But the fact that a state decided not to regulate something way back when it may not have been so dangerous, but chooses now to do so because it's very dangerous, is a fact, changed fact, that should be pretty relevant to us. And it's really hard, frankly, to read the Bruin opinion from Justice Thomas and think that what's going on there is really something different than him giving effect to his preference for gun rights. It's really hard to read that Mr. Originalism and all of his pans to history and tradition, including post-ratification history and tradition, without thinking that what's really going on here is not an interpretation of the Constitution, but an effectuation of his political preferences. A word about the First Amendment. We don't have a text, history, and tradition test for the First Amendment. We don't look to historical analogs for the First Amendment. But we could. And maybe we will. So take speech of the First Amendment. The best evidence tells us that the original understanding of the First Amendment permitted criminalization of criticisms of the government. The Alien and Sedition Acts, which today and for 150 years, if not longer, 200 years, have been taken as sort of the epitome of governmental overreach and paradigmatic violations of the First Amendment. The best recent historical work, done especially by Judd Campbell, now at Stanford, suggests that actually the Sedition Act was constitutional based on the original understanding. It was permissible for Congress to criminalize criticism of the government. What about criminalization of blasphemy? Can a state today criminalize blasphemous utterances? Crazy! No possible way, consistent with our self-understanding of our government as a liberal government. We do not criminalize criticisms of the government and blasphemy, for God's sake. But we could, consistent with the original understanding. Is that where we're headed? Is that what Heller and Bruin foretell outside of the Second Amendment? That we are going to look back to history and tradition and figure out what was allowed then without any regard for the extent to which the past is a very foreign country and we live in an entirely different world? Yes. Yes, that might be where we are headed. Thanks.
I guess we should throw the floor open to questions. And then you stay up there. C2. Yeah, I think it will arise. And for those of you who are going to go into criminal law, the majority reaffirmed a decision called Salerno, which I don't like. And the Fifth Circuit said, oh, you know, that was back in the 90s. You know, it's kind of fallen from favor. And the Chief Justice Roberts said, well, no, actually, we still like it. And the point is, of Salerno is a facial challenge can only succeed when you basically show there are no or virtually no set of circumstances under which the law can be constitutional. And so the Rahimi majority says C1 is clearly constitutional in at least some applications and, you know, if certainly in Rahimi's case. All of the briefing, other than mine on behalf of the Independence Institute where I work and a group of law professors with expertise in Second Amendment issues, basically avoided any distinction between C1 and C2. And my brief said C1 is okay, you know, for what amounts to the majority reasoning, because it's an individual fact-finding, C2 doesn't have any fact-finding at all, and it's not. And I will, to pat myself on the back, mine was the only amicus brief to which the Solicitor General addressed in her reply brief. And it was an issue that came up raised by both Justices Alito and Gorsuch at oral argument, and even by Solicitor General Preloger in her rebuttal part of the oral argument. So the court in Rahimi just says we're not saying anything about C2, which does show that, you know, amicus, and I didn't get a citation out of it from the court, although the Wall Street Journal editorial page mentioned the brief and sort of suggested that my approach might be the right way to do it. But everybody was so wrapped up in the thing of either, you know, gun control is good, gun control is bad, and so it's either got a, they looked at it as a unitary thing, and I think that's one way amicus briefs can be helpful to courts and for you. And that's a thing a person can do early in their career, particularly in lower appellate courts, is to write a useful amicus brief, you know, for an intermediate court of appeals or a state Supreme Court or whatever. And when you show, you give the court something different from just going me too to one side or another. Yes, sir. Oh, I think we could, it would be fun for us to, you know, sit around for a few hours and talk about that. You can, and obviously he's an eminent scholar of jurisprudence in general and has his, you know, lots of theoretical arguments against originalism as a methodology in general, regardless of whether it's applied in, you know, and he would concede whenever applied in good faith, and he doesn't think some cases were. I'd say the you can get good argument. A good way to look at this is Justice Kavanaugh joined the Rahimi majority, but he wrote separately and at some length about why he thinks originalism is a certainly imperfect method, but better than all the others, because it does a better job of constraining judges to be tethered to something rather than balancing tests, which is ultimately the judge doing the balancing himself or herself. And you get a similar debate in McDonald v. Chicago, where Justice Scalia joined Justice Alito's majority opinion, and Justice Stevens dissented, and the Stevens dissent is, you know, especially on squishy things like the unenumerated rights that are implicit in the 14th Amendment, you know, this is a matter of wise judicial discretion and all this kind of thing. And Justice Scalia wrote Justice Stevens' final opinion, and it's of course it's very well written, wrote a concurrence that addresses that and says, no, you know, we're not Platonic guardians. You know, the best methodology is one that leaves, that doesn't have a lot of, that reduces changing from judge A to judge B, and you get a different result in there. You know, and there are good arguments there. On terms of the, specifically whether Heller or Bruin were proper applications of originalism, two things. One, purpose clauses, as explained by an article by Eugene Volokh in the 1998 NYU Law Review, were common in state constitutions. Thrift and economy being necessary in a young state, the legislature may not raise its pay. Even if you don't think the purpose clause applies anymore, you know, New Hampshire is no longer young and it's got more money than it knows how to spend, the legislature still can't vote to raise its own pay. The purported ambiguity in the main clause of the Second Amendment is a fabrication and a dishonest one by a small coterie of law scholars, most notably history professor Saul Cornell of Fordham. Of course, bear arms is used in a military context. It certainly is. I mean, you certainly bear arms in a militia, and if you're in a country that's recently is at war, you're going to have plenty of newspaper articles that mention that. But James Madison, the author of the Second Amendment, wrote a draft Virginia legislature bill against poaching and said if you're caught poaching, then you can't bear arms off your own land for a year. That was plainly referring to bearing arms as not a, and in fact, it had a militia exception. Like, of course, if you got to go for militia duty, then of course you can. Say the leading constitutional law treatise of the early Republic was written by federal judge and William and Mary law professor St. George Tucker, published in 1801, clearly describes the Second Amendment as an individual right for all lawful purposes, including self-defense, hunting, and certainly collective defense against any form of tyranny or invasion. This guy Cornell goes to William and Mary, reads St. George Tucker's lecture notes from 1792-93 for his class, and writes an article saying, well, actually, Tucker had a very different view in 1792 than he did now. And who knows what the St. George Tucker lecture notes are not published online. Justice Stevens buys this claim from Cornell, and it appears in Justice Stevens' dissent in Heller. Well, then later another lawyer, my friend David Hardy, went to William and Mary, looked at the lecture notes himself, and found, Cornell's St. George Tucker's lecture notes on the Second Amendment are nearly identical and verbatim to what he wrote in his 1801 treatise. So there was no, contrary to what Cornell claimed, some change of opinion by Professor Tucker over the decade. So I'll say that, and this can go on and on, but I would suggest that the evidence that Heller and Bruin were correctly decided, that the Second Amendment is an individual right that is intended to support militia service but is not dependent on it, and Bruin's holding that the right to keep and bear arms includes the right to carry a gun in public without having to prove you are specially unique from the general public, are overwhelmingly supported by original meaning.
I'm going to jump in there.
Okay.
I don't think that's a fair characterization of the history, but we're not going to be able to argue out the history here. Go read the opinions yourselves. Read the historians who've written on this. Saul Cornell, by the way, is going to be here next week. He's invited by the Law and History workshop. So he's not talking about gun rights, I don't believe, but if you're interested in seeing Saul Cornell, I think he's here a week from tomorrow. So
he is an excellent speaker, very glib, entertaining, but do not buy a used car from him.
But the other thing I also want to say, that's the other thing I want to say about those, Kavanaugh saying originalism, has problems, but it's better than all the others.
Right. Yeah.
Except text, history, and tradition isn't originalism. It's a different methodology. So you can't say originalism the best except for all those. That's why we're going to stick with originalism. And our methodology is text, history, and tradition. Different thing. Different thing. So it's pluralism. It's a bunch of different considerations, all for pluralism. The original meaning matters, but history and tradition matters too. I'm not against that. But then stop telling us a story that you are originalist. You're doing different stuff. And there are certain things you don't like, okay. But it looks a lot better to say there's this one thing that matters. There's not this one thing that matters, people. There's not this one thing that matters. History matters. And history also is what brings us to this place with regard to the First Amendment. It's not okay for the state to criminalize criticism of the government. Do you really think otherwise? Things change.
I want to sort of agree with that. Obviously, there are some people who would say, look, if you're doing original public meaning, then you got to have some cutoff. And one of my friends and colleagues, Rob Nadelson, would say, well, you can at most go up through, when North Carolina and Rhode Island, the holdouts, finally ratified the Constitution and joined the Union. And so, what happened in 1801? Whatever that matters is not originalism, and that is true in a strict definition of the word. What people like, say, Robert Leiter of George Mason would say is Madison talked about. Look, we've got some things in the Constitution that are very clear. President's got to be a certain age, two senators per state. And Kavanaugh recapitulates this, but we also have more open-ended phrases like the freedom of speech and. Those would be decided, Madison said, by liquidation, by we're going to have to go through things and, just work it out and see what it means. Our wonderful and elaborate doctrines of freedom of the freedom of speech, in terms of, well, if the government puts up a billboard, that's one thing. But can the government, what if you have the government, it's public transportation and all those things. You can't just derive those from the text or from prior practices. We're going to have to figure out what they mean in practice, and that's what Berwyn essentially says, and Heller, which is, yeah, we have the original meaning of these things as rights, but, you know, when you get to the applications on the edge, we're going to have to, you know, figure it out as we go along. And they would say, and those things were not inconsistent with the original meaning. I agree it's not pure. And you were also right that, well, the Sedition Act, there were arguments back and forth when it was enacted, and people made First Amendment arguments against it. The people who were arguing for it said, well, it's actually the most liberal type of seditious libel law that's been enacted because it actually allows truth as a defense in the libel case. But the problem is there was no defense to opinion, and that's where the prosecutions happened. Yes, ma'am.
So in the discussion of Rahimi, I'm very curious. So, you know, regardless of the relevant time period we're talking about, if it's the ratification of the Constitution or if it's the ratification of the 14th Amendment in 1868, regardless, women didn't have the right to vote, and also men had the right to beat their wives.
No, they didn't. And that's in the Rahimi briefing. But anyway, women didn't have the right to vote except in New Jersey, and they lost that before the 14th Amendment was enacted. Yes.
My point here is that in Berwyn, Justice Thomas makes several arguments about the fact that modern day weapons are allowed to be considered for modern day use.
Yeah.
However, his dissent in Rahimi said actually the Fifth Circuit was right. You know, this sort of provision is not constitutional. And so I'm wondering what your thought is when we have modern weapons and modern innovations and technology that are allowed, but the law underlying it in and of itself doesn't allow for actual social advancements that have been made in the same way.
Sure. There's so many things to think about in that, right? And so clearly technology has to keep the Bill of Rights, the Constitution in general, set up enduring principles, and those don't change when technology gets better. So the amount in libel, the amount of harm you could do by libeling somebody in a newspaper in 1791 was limited to the distribution of that newspaper. Now false statements go around the world in seconds. With our much more, guns have improved a lot in the last 200 years, but not only a tiny fraction of how fast newspapers and communications have improved. So the dangers of false statements are way worse now. In around 2005, Newsweek falsely reported that at the Guantanamo Detention Center, a Koran had been flushed down the toilet. Completely made up. But anyway, they said it. And that was in Pakistan and Turkey within minutes, and it led to riots where non-Muslims were murdered because of that false statement by, you know, Newsweek. That couldn't have happened in the olden days. But so things keep up. And yes, and social beliefs change as well. So you're right, women were, other than in New Jersey, not voters. And we, fortunately, we have an amendment process, and of course states change their own constitutions long before the 19th Amendment brought in the recalcitrant ones on that. And we, a constitution that is supposed to be made for the ages has to keep up with the ages. But in the amendment process, the 19th Amendment is part of that.
It's a good question. I like the answer too. And I should say I really appreciate your responses to me as well. I don't know how to compare the change in communication and the change in guns. We didn't have handguns. That seems like a
pretty they did.
But not in a realistic, really very usable fashion. No one would assault someone with the way people assaulted people generally was with axes and knives. It's very hard to quickly assault someone with what most people own there were long guns. The armament technology, the types of firearms that individuals can use and carry now, and their destructive potential, is not just a little bit more than it was in 1791. For whatever relevance that is, let's not minimize the change in firearm technology between
now. Well, officers routinely carried handguns in the militia. And as officers in the U.S. military today routinely carry handguns, if you hadn't loaded your handgun and you wanted to assault someone 2 seconds from now, yes, you'd be better off chasing them with an axe. If your handgun was loaded, handguns were constantly loaded and carried for, among other things, for protection by people while traveling or inside. Coats were made to have two deep interior pockets for a pair of handguns. I mean, great, guns are much better, but by the way, that particular revolution in firearms, the most important thing of it was the invention of the modern metallic cartridge, which is, if you ever see a piece of ammunition, a round of ammunition contains the primer, the gunpowder, the bullet, all wrapped in a metallic cartridge. That was an extremely significant invention. It began coming onto the market in the 1850s, and by the time the 14th Amendment was being ratified in 1866 to 68, you had things like the Winchester Model 1866, which could fire 17 shots without reloading. So I agree, the metallic cartridges are gigantic, but they don't come close to the advances we've had in lots of other things, like the First Amendment. Oh, and on technology changing, as the United Kyllo, K-Y-L-L-O, the Supreme Court correctly decided, thermal imaging, which allows remote off-premises spying into the heat signatures within a building, that was a thing that was never, nobody could do that in 1791, and that the court correctly recognized that that was a search into the home that should require a warrant. So everything has to keep up with technology. But it doesn't change the Constitution. It just means there are new applications. Follow up?
Yeah. I guess that my secondary point there is that if we're going to allow for new technologies, then why are the gun laws that we have to use, why do they have to be analogous to the ones that were used in the early 1800s? If we have new technology with firearms that we're going to allow, why can we not allow new adaptations in the sort of laws we're considering?
And Bruin basically agrees with you to an extent, because it basically says you can be looser on drawing analogies with new technologies. So when somebody invents death laser contact lenses, so you can just, if you stare really hard at someone, you can shoot a laser that kills them. The analogies on concealed weapons might get looser, I don't know. But Bruin agrees with you on that.
Thank you. Looks like we still have some extra food, so feel free to grab some, and feel free to come up and ask some questions if you have more.
Thank you both.
Thanks. That's what we're
doing. Yeah, thank you. The room is very engaged. Thank you, Mr. Berman. We always appreciate your introduction.